Struggling for Justice at Home and Abroad, 1901-1945. The new century brought astonishing changes to the United States. Victory in the Spanish-American War made it clear that the United States was now a world power. Industrialization ushered in giant corporations, sprawling factories, sweatshop labor, and the ubiquitous automobile. A huge wave of immigration was altering the face of the nation, especially the cities, where a majority of Americans lived by 1920. With bigger cities came bigger fears of crime, vice, poverty, and disease. Changes of such magnitude raised vexing questions. What role should the United States play in the world? How could the enormous power of industry be controlled? How would the millions of new immigrants make their way in America? What should the country do about poverty, disease, and the continuing plague of racial inequality? All these issues turned on a fundamental point: should government remain narrowly limited in its powers, or did the times require a more potent government that would actively shape society and secure American interests abroad? The progressive movement represented the first attempt to answer those questions. Reform-minded men and women from all walks of life and from both major parties shared in the progressive crusade for greater government activism. Buoyed by this outlook, Presidents Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and Woodrow Wilson enlarged the capacity of government to fight graft, bust business trusts, regulate corporations, and promote fair labor practices, child welfare, conservation, and consumer protection. These progressive reformers, convinced that women would bring greater morality to politics, bolstered the decades-long struggle for female suffrage. Women finally secured the vote in 1920 with the ratification of the 19th Amendment. The progressive era precedents also challenged America's tradition of isolationism in foreign policy. They felt the country had a moral obligation to spread democracy and an economic opportunity to reap profits in foreign markets. Roosevelt and Taft launched diplomatic initiatives in the Caribbean, Central America, and East Asia. Wilson aspired to make the world safer democracy by rallying support for American intervention in the First World War. The progressive spirit waned, however, as the United States retreated during the 1920s into what President Harding called normalcy. Isolationist sentiment revived with a vengeance. Blessed with a booming economy, Americans turned their gaze inward to baseball heroes, radio, jazz, movies, and the first mass-produced American automobile, the Model T Ford. Presidents Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover backed off from the economic regulatory zeal of their predecessors. Normalcy also had a brutal side. Thousands of suspected radicals were jailed or deported in the Red Scare of 1919 and 1920. Anti-immigrant passions flared until immigration quotas in 1924 squeezed the flow of new corners to a trickle. Race riots scorched several northern cities in the summer of 1919, a sign of how embittered race relations had become in the wake of the great migration of southern blacks to wartime jobs in northern industry. A reborn Ku Klux Klan staged a comeback, not just in the South but in the North and West as well. Normalcy itself soon proved short-lived, a casualty of the stock market crash of 1929 and the Great Depression that followed. As Americans watched banks fail, businesses collapse, and millions of people lose their jobs, they asked with renewed urgency what role the government should play in rescuing the nation. President Franklin D. Roosevelt's answer was the New Deal and ambitious array of relief programs, public works, and economic regulations that failed to cure the Depression but furnished an impressive legacy of social reforms. Most Americans came to accept an expanded federal government role at home under FDR's leadership in the 1930s, but they still clung stubbornly to isolationism. The United States did little in the 1930s to check the rising military aggression of Japan and Germany. By the early 1940s, events forced Americans to reconsider. Once Hitler's Germany had seized control of most of Europe, Roosevelt, who had long opposed the isolationists, found ways to aid a beleaguered Britain. When Japan attacked the American naval base at Pearl Harbor in December 1941, isolationists at last fell silent. Roosevelt led a stunned but determined nation into the Second World War, and victory in 1945 positioned the United States to assume a commanding position in the post-war world order. The Great Depression and the Second World War brought to a head a half century of debate over the role of government and the place of the United States in the world. In the name of a struggle for justice, Roosevelt established a new era of government activism at home and internationalism abroad. The New Deal's legacy set the terms of debate in American political life for the rest of the century. Progressivism and the Republican Roosevelt. 1901-1912. When I say I believe in a square deal, I do not mean to give every man the best hand. If the cards do not come to any man, or if they do come and he has not got the power to play them, that is his affair. All I mean is that there shall be no crookedness in the dealing. Theodore Roosevelt, 1905. Nearly 76 million Americans greeted the new century in 1900. Almost one in seven of them was foreign-born. In the 14 years of peace that remained before the Great War of 1914 engulfed the globe, 13 million more migrants would carry their bundles down the gangplanks to the land of promise. Hardly had the 20th century dawned on the ethnically and racially mixed American people than they were convulsed by a reform movement, the likes of which the nation had not seen since the 1840s. The new crusaders, who called themselves progressives, waged war on many evils, notably monopoly, corruption, inefficiency, and social injustice. The progressive army was large, diverse, and widely deployed, but it had a single battle cry: strengthen the state. The real heart of the movement, explained one of the progressive reformers, was to use government as an agency of human welfare. The groundswell of the new reformist wave went far back, to the Greenback Labor Party of the 1870s and the populists of the 1890s, to the mounting unrest throughout the land as grasping industrialists concentrated more and more power in fewer hands. An outworn philosophy of hands-off individualism seemed increasingly out of place in the modern machine age. Social and economic problems were now too complex for the intentionally feeble Jeffersonian organs of government. Progressive theorists were insisting that society could no longer afford the luxury of a limitless, let alone laissez-faire policy. The people, through government, must substitute mastery for drift. Well before 1900, perceptive politicians and writers had begun to pinpoint targets for the progressive attack. Bryan, Altgeld, and the populace loudly branded the bloated trusts with a stigma of corruption and wrongdoing. In 1894, Henry de Maurice Lloyd charged headlong into the Standard Oil Company with his book Wealth Against Commonwealth. Eccentric Thorstein Veblen assailed the new rich with his prickly pen and a theory of the leisure class, a savage attack on predatory wealth and conspicuous consumption. In Veblen's view, the parasitic leisure class engaged in wasteful business or making money for money's sake rather than productive industry or making goods to satisfy real needs. He urged that social leadership pass from these superfluous titans to truly useful engineers. Other pen-wielding knights likewise entered the fray. The keen-eyed and keen-nosed Danish immigrant Jacob A. Riis, a reporter for the New York Sun, shocked middle-class Americans in 1890 with How the Other Half Lives. His account was a damning indictment of the dirt, disease, vice, and misery of the rat-gnawed human rookeries known as New York slums. The book deeply influenced a future New York City police commissioner, Theodore Roosevelt. Novelist Theodore Dreiser used his blunt prose to batter promoters and profiteers in the financier and the titan. Caustic critics of social injustice issued from several other corners. Socialists, many of whom were European immigrants inspired by the strong movement for state socialism in the Old World, began to register appreciable strength at the ballot box. High-minded messengers of the social gospel promoted a brand of progressivism based on Christian teachings. They used religious doctrine to demand better housing and living conditions for the urban poor. Feminists in multiplying numbers added social justice to suffrage on their list of needed reforms. With urban pioneers like Jane Addams in Chicago and Lillian Wald in New York blazing the way, women entered the fight to improve the lot of families living and working in the festering cities. Beginning about 1902, the exposing of evil became a flourishing industry among American publishers. A group of aggressive 10 and 15 cent popular magazines surged to the front, notably McClure's, Cosmopolitan, Collier's, and Everybody's. Waging fierce circulation wars, they dug deep for the dirt that the public loved to hate. Enterprising editors financed extensive research and encouraged pugnacious writing by their bright young reporters, whom President Roosevelt branded as muckrakers in 1906. Annoyed by their excess of zeal, he compared the mudslinging magazine Dirt Diggers to the figure in Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress who was so intent on raking manure that he could not see the celestial crown dangling overhead. Despite presidential scolding, these muckrakers boomed circulation, and some of their most scandalous exposures were published as best-selling books. The reformer writers range far, wide, and deep in their crusade to lay bare the muck of iniquity in American society. In 1902, a brilliant New York reporter, Lincoln Steffens, launched a series of articles in McClure's titled The Shame of the Cities. He fearlessly unmasked the corrupt alliance between big business and municipal government. Steffens was followed in the same magazine by Ida M. Tarbell, a pioneering journalist who published a devastating but factual exposé of the Standard Oil Company. Her father had been ruined by the oil interests. Fearing legal reprisals, the muckraking magazines went to great pains and expense to check their material, paying as much as $3,000 to verify a single Tarbell article. Plucky muckrakers fearlessly tilted their pen lances at varied targets. They assailed the malpractices of life insurance companies and tariff lobbies. They roasted the beef trust, the money trust, the railroad barons, and the corrupt amassing of American fortunes. Thomas W. Lawson, an erratic speculator who had himself made $50 million on the stock market, laid bare the practices of his accomplices in frenzied finance. This series of articles, appearing in 1905-1906, rocketed the circulation of everybody's. Lawson, by fouling his own nest, made many enemies among his rich associates, and he died a poor man. David G. Phillips shocked an already startled nation by his series in Cosmopolitan titled The Treason of the Senate. He boldly charged that 75 of the 90 senators did not represent the people at all but the railroads and trusts. This withering indictment, buttressed by facts, impressed President Roosevelt. Phillips continued his attacks through novels and was fatally shot in 1911 by a deranged young man whose family he had allegedly maligned. Some of the most effective fire of the muckrakers was directed at social evils. The ugly list included the immoral white slave traffic in women, the rickety slums, and the appalling number of industrial accidents. The sorry subjugation of America's 9 million blacks, of whom 90% still lived in the South and one-third were illiterate, was spotlighted in Ray Stannard Baker's Following the Color Line. The abuses of child labor were brought luridly to light by John Spargo's The Bitter Cry of the Children. Vendors of potent patent medicines, often heavily spiked with alcohol, likewise came in for bitter criticism. These conscienceless vultures sold incredible quantities of adulterated or habit-forming drugs, while doping the press with lavish advertising. Muckraking attacks in Collier's were ably reinforced by Dr. Harvey W. Wiley, chief chemist of the Department of Agriculture, who with his famous poison squad performed experiments on himself. Full of sound and fury, the muckrakers signified much about the nature of the progressive reform movement. They were long on limitation and short on sweeping remedies. To right social wrongs, they counted on publicity and an aroused public conscience, not drastic political change. They sought not to overthrow capitalism but to cleanse it. The cure for the ills of American democracy, they earnestly believed, was more democracy. Progressive reformers were mainly middle-class men and women who felt themselves squeezed from above and below. They sensed pressure from the new giant corporations, the restless immigrant hordes, and the aggressive labor unions. The progressives simultaneously saw two goals: to use state power to curb the trusts and to stem the socialist threat by generally improving the common person's conditions of life and labor. Progressives emerged in both major parties, in all regions, and at all levels of government. The truth is that progressivism was less a minority movement and more a majority mood. One of the first objectives of progressives was to regain the power that had slipped from the hands of the people into those of the interests. These ardent reformers pushed for direct primary elections so as to undercut power-hungry party bosses. They favored the initiative so that voters could directly propose legislation themselves, thus bypassing the boss-bought state legislatures. Progressives also agitated for the referendum. This device would place laws on the ballot for final approval by the people, especially laws that had been railroaded through a compliant legislature by free spending agents of big business. The recall would enable the voters to remove faithless elected officials, particularly those who had been bribed by bosses or lobbyists. Rooting out graft also became a prime goal of earnest progressives. A number of the state legislatures passed corrupt practices acts, which limited the amount of money that candidates could spend for their election. Such legislation also restricted huge gifts from corporations, for which the donors would expect special favors. The secret Australian ballot was likewise being introduced more widely in the states to counteract boss rule. Bribery was less feasible when bribers could not tell if they were getting their money's worth from the bribed. Direct election of U.S. senators became a favorite goal of progressives, especially after the muckrakers had exposed the scandalous intimacy between greedy corporations and Congress. By 1900, the Senate had so many rich men that it was often sneered at as a billionaire's club. Too many of these prosperous solons, elected as they then were by trust-dominated legislatures, heeded the voice of their masters rather than the voice of the masses. A constitutional amendment to bring about the popular election of senators had rough sledding in Congress, for the plutocratic members of the Senate were happy with existing methods. But a number of states established primary elections in which the voters expressed their preferences for the Senate. The local legislatures, when choosing senators, found it politically wise to heed the voice of the people. Partly as a result of such pressures, the 17th Amendment to the Constitution, approved in 1913, established the direct election of U.S. senators. But the expected improvement in caliber was slow in coming. Woman suffrage, the goal of feminists for many decades, likewise received powerful new support from the progressives early in the 1900s. The political reformers believed that women's votes would elevate the political tone, and the foes of the saloon felt that they could count on the support of enfranchised females. The suffragists, with their cry of votes for women and equal suffrage for men and women, protested bitterly against taxation without representation. Many of the states, especially the more liberal ones in the West, gradually extended the vote to women. But by 1910, nationwide female suffrage was still a decade away, and a suffragist could still be sneeringly defined as one who has ceased to be a lady and has not yet become a gentleman. Progressives scored some of their most impressive gains in the cities. Frustrated by the inefficiency and corruption of machine-oiled city government, many localities followed the pioneering example of Galveston, Texas. In 1901, it had appointed expert staff commissions to manage urban affairs. Other communities adopted the city manager system, also designed to take politics out of municipal administration. Some of these reforms obviously valued efficiency more highly than democracy, as control of civic affairs was further removed from the people's hands. Urban reformers likewise attacked slumlords, juvenile delinquency, and wide-open prostitution vice at a price, which flourished in red-light districts unchallenged by bribed police. Public-spirited city dwellers also moved to halt the corrupt sale of franchises for streetcars and other public utilities. Progressivism naturally bubbled up to the state level, notably in Wisconsin, which became a yeasty laboratory of reform. The governor of the state, Pompadour Robert M. Fighting Bob La Follette, was an undersized but overbearing crusader who emerged as the most militant of the progressive Republican leaders. After a desperate fight with entrenched monopoly, he reached the governor's chair in 1901. Routing the lumber and railroad interests, he wrested considerable control from the crooked corporations and returned it to the people. He also perfected a scheme for regulating public utilities, while laboring in close association with experts on the faculty of the State University at Madison. Other states marched steadily toward the progressive camp, as they undertook to regulate railroads and trusts, chiefly through public utilities commissions. Oregon was not far behind Wisconsin, and California made giant boot strides under the stocky Hiram W. Johnson. Elected Republican governor in 1910, this dynamic prosecutor of grafters helped break the dominant grip of the Southern Pacific Railroad on California politics and then, like La Follette, set up a political machine of his own. Heavily whiskered Charles Evans Hughes, the able and audacious reformist Republican governor of New York, had earlier gained national fame as an investigator of malpractices by gas and insurance companies and by the coal trust. women proved themselves an indispensable part of the Progressive Army. A crucial focus for women's activism was the Settlement House movement. At a time when women could neither vote nor hold political office, settlement houses offered a side door to public life. They exposed middle-class women to the problems plaguing America's cities, including poverty, political corruption, and intolerable working and living conditions. They also gave them the skills and confidence to attack those evils. The women's club movement provided an even broader civic entryway for many middle-class women. Literary clubs, where educated women met to improve themselves with poetry and prose, had existed for decades. But in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, many of these clubs set aside Shakespeare and Henry James for social issues and current events. Dante has been dead for several centuries, observed the president of the General Federation of Women's Clubs in 1904. I think it is time that we drop the study of his Inferno and turned our attention to our own. 19th century notions of separate spheres dictated that a woman's place was in the home, so most female progressives defended their new activities as an extension, not a rejection, of the traditional roles of wife and mother. Thus they were often drawn to moral and maternal issues like keeping children out of smudgy mills and sweltering sweatshops, attacking the scourge of tuberculosis bred in airless tenements, winning pensions for mothers with dependent children, and ensuring that only safe food products found their way to the family table. Female activists agitated through organizations like the Women's Trade Union League and the National Consumers League, as well as through two new federal agencies, the Children's Bureau and the Women's Bureau, both in the Department of Labor. These wedges into the federal bureaucracy, however small, gave female reformers a national stage for social investigation and advocacy. Campaigns for factory reform and temperance particularly attracted women foot soldiers. Unsafe and unsanitary sweatshops, factories where workers toiled long hours for low wages, were a public scandal in many cities. Florence Kelly, a former resident of Jane Addams's Hill House, became the state of Illinois' first chief factory inspector and one of the nation's leading advocates for improved factory conditions. In 1899, Kelly took control of a newly founded National Consumers League, which mobilized female consumers to pressure for laws safeguarding women and children in the workplace. In the landmark case Mueller v. Oregon, crusading attorney Louis B. Brandeis persuaded the Supreme Court to accept the constitutionality of laws protecting women workers by presenting evidence of the harmful effects of factory labor on women's weaker bodies. Although this argument calling for special protection for women seemed discriminatory by later standards and closed many male jobs to women, progressives at the time hailed Brandeis's achievement as a triumph over existing legal doctrine, which afforded employers total control over the workplace. The American welfare state that emerged from female activism focused more on protecting women and children than on granting benefits to everyone, as was the case in much of Western Europe, with its stronger labor movements. Crusaders for these humane measures did not always have smooth sailing. One dismaying setback came in 1905, when the Supreme Court, in Lochner v. New York, invalidated a New York law establishing a 10-hour day for bakers. Yet the reformist progressive wave finally washed up into the judiciary, and in 1917 the court upheld a 10-hour law for factory workers. Laws regulating factories were worthless if not enforced, a truth horribly demonstrated by a lethal fire in 1911 at the Triangle Shirt Waist Company in New York City. Locked doors and other flagrant violations of the fire code turned the factory into a death trap. 146 workers, most of them young immigrant women, were incinerated or leapt from 8th and 9th story windows to their deaths. Lashed by the public outcry, including a massive strike by women in the needle trades, the New York legislature passed much stronger laws regulating the hours and conditions of sweatshop toil. Other legislatures followed, and by 1917, 30 states had put workers' compensation laws on the books, providing insurance to workers injured in industrial accidents. Gradually, the concept of the employer's responsibility to society was replacing the old dog-eat-dog philosophy of unregulated free enterprise. Corner saloons, with their shutter doors, not rarely attracted the ire and fire of progressives. Alcohol was intimately connected with prostitution in red-light districts, with the drunken voter, with crooked city officials dominated by booze interests, and with the blowsy boss who counted poker chips by night and miscounted ballots by day, including the cemetery vote. By 1900, cities like New York and San Francisco had one saloon for about every 200 people. And Tillichur campaigners received powerful support from several militant organizations, notably the Women's Christian Temperance Union WCTU. Founder Frances E. Willard, who would fall to her knees in prayer on saloon floors, mobilized nearly 1 million women to make the world home-like and built the WCTU into the largest organization of women in the world. She found a vigorous ally in the Anti-Saloon League, which was aggressive, well-organized, and well-financed. Caught up in the crusade, some states and numerous counties passed dry laws, which controlled, restricted, or abolished alcohol. The big cities were generally wet, for they had a large immigrant vote accustomed in the old country to the free flow of wine and beer. When World War I erupted in 1914, nearly one half of the population lived in dry territory, and nearly three-fourths of the total area had outlawed saloons. Demon Rum was groggy and about to be floored, temporarily, by the 18th Amendment in 1919. Theodore Roosevelt, although something of an imperialistic busybody abroad, was touched by the progressive wave at home. Like other reformers, he feared that the public interest was being submerged in the drifting seas of indifference. Everybody's interest was nobody's interest. Roosevelt decided to make it his. His sportsman's instincts spurred him into demanding a square deal for capital, labor, and the public at large. Broadly speaking, the president's program embraced three C's: control of the corporations, consumer protection, and conservation of natural resources. The square deal for labor received its acid test in 1902, when a crippling strike broke out in the anthracite coal mines of Pennsylvania. Some 140,000 besuited workers, many of them illiterate immigrants, had long been frightfully exploited and accident-plagued. They demanded, among other improvements, a 20% increase in pay and a reduction of the working day from 10 to 9 hours. Unsympathetic mine owners, confident that a chilled public would react against the miners, refused to arbitrate or even negotiate. One of their spokesmen, multimillionaire George E. Bear, reflected the high and mighty attitude of certain ungenerous employers. Workers, he wrote, would be cared for not by the labor agitators, but by the Christian men to whom God in His infinite wisdom has given the control of the property interests of this country. As coal supplies dwindled, factories and schools were forced to shut down, and even hospitals felt the icy grip of winter. Desperately seeking a solution, Roosevelt summoned representatives of the striking miners and the mine owners to the White House. He was profoundly annoyed by the extraordinary stupidity and bad temper of the wooden-headed gentry who operated the mines. As he later confessed, if it had not been for the dignity of his high office, he would have taken one of them by the seat of the breeches and chucked him out of the window. Roosevelt finally resorted to his trusty big stick when he threatened to seize the mines and operate them with federal troops. Faced with this first-time-ever threat to use federal bayonets against capital, rather than labor, the owners grudgingly consented to arbitration. A compromise decision ultimately gave the miners a 10% pay boost and a working day of 9 hours. But their union was not officially recognized as a bargaining agent. Keenly aware of the mounting antagonisms between capital and labor, Roosevelt urged Congress to create the new Department of Commerce and Labor. This goal was achieved in 1903. 10 years later, the agency was split in two. An important arm of the newborn cabinet body was the Bureau of Corporations, which was authorized to probe businesses engaged in interstate commerce. The Bureau was highly useful in helping to break the stranglehold of monopoly and in clearing the road for the era of trust busting. The sprawling railroad octopus sorely needed restraint. The Interstate Commerce Commission, created in 1887 as a feeble SOP to the public, had proved woefully inadequate. Railroad barons could simply appeal the commission's decisions on rates to the federal courts, a process that might take 10 years. Spurred by the former cowboy president, Congress passed effective railroad legislation, beginning with the Elkins Act of 1903. This curb was aimed primarily at the rebate evil. Heavy fines could now be imposed both on the railroads that gave rebates and on the shippers that accepted them. Still more effective was the Hepburn Act of 1906. Free passes, with their hint of bribery, were severely restricted. The once infantile Interstate Commerce Commission was expanded, and its reach was extended to include express companies, sleeping car companies, and pipelines. For the first time, the commission was given real molars when it was authorized, on complaint of shippers, to nullify existing rates and stipulate maximum rates. Railroads also provided Roosevelt with an opportunity to brandish his antitrust bludgeon. Trust had come to be a fighting word in the progressive era. Roosevelt believed that these industrial behemoths, with their efficient means of production, had arrived to stay. He concluded that there were good trusts, with public consciences, and bad trusts, which lusted greedily for power. He was determined to respond to the popular outcry against the trusts, but was also determined not to throw out the baby with the bathwater by indiscriminately smashing all large businesses. Roosevelt, as a trust buster, first burst into the headlines in 1902 with an attack on the Northern Securities Company, a railroad holding company organized by financial titan J.P. Morgan and empire builder James J. Hill. These Napoleonic moguls of money sought to achieve a virtual monopoly of the railroads in the Northwest. Roosevelt was therefore challenging the most regal potentates of the industrial aristocracy. The railway promoters appealed to the Supreme Court, which in 1904 upheld Roosevelt's antitrust suit and ordered the Northern Securities Company to be dissolved. The Northern Securities decision jolted Wall Street and angered big business, but greatly enhanced Roosevelt's reputation as a trust smasher. Roosevelt's big stick crashed down on other giant monopolies, as he initiated over 40 legal proceedings against them. The Supreme Court in 1905 declared the Beef Trust illegal, and the heavy fist of justice fell upon monopolists controlling sugar, fertilizer, harvesters, and other key products. Much mythology has inflated Roosevelt's reputation as a trust buster. The Rough Rider understood the political popularity of monopoly smashing, but he did not consider it sound economic policy. Combination and integration, he felt, were the hallmarks of the age, and to try to stem the tide of economic progress by political means he considered the rankest folly. Bigness was not necessarily badness, so why punish success? Roosevelt's real purpose in assaulting the Goliaths of industry was symbolic, to prove conclusively that the government, not private business, ruled the country. He believed in regulating, not fragmenting, the big business combines. The threat of dissolution, he felt, might make the sultans of the smokestacks more amenable to federal regulation, as it did. In truth, Roosevelt never swung his trust-crushing stick with maximum force. In many ways the huge industrial behemoths were healthier, though perhaps more tame at the end of Roosevelt's reign than they had been before. His successor, William Howard Taft, actually busted more trusts than T.R. did. In one celebrated instance in 1907, Roosevelt even gave his personal blessing to J.P. Morgan's plan to have U.S. Steel absorb the Tennessee Coal and Iron Company, without fear of antitrust reprisals. When Taft then launched a suit against U.S. Steel in 1911, the political reaction from T.R. was explosive. Roosevelt backed a noteworthy measure in 1906 that benefited both corporations and consumers. Big meat packers were being shut out of certain European markets because some American meat, from the small packing houses, claimed the giants, had been found to be tainted. Foreign governments were even threatening to ban all American meat imports by throwing out the good beef with the bad botulism. At the same time, American consumers hungered for safer canned products. Their appetite for reform was whetted by Upton Sinclair's sensational novel The Jungle, published in 1906. Sinclair intended his revolting tract to focus attention on the plight of the workers in the big canning factories, but instead he appalled the public with his description of disgustingly unsanitary food products. As he put it, he aimed for the nation's heart but hit its stomach. The book described in noxious detail the filth, disease, and putrefaction in Chicago's damp, ill-ventilated slaughterhouses. Many readers, including Roosevelt, were so sickened that for a time they found meat unpalatable. The president was moved by the loathsome mess in Chicago to appoint a special investigating commission, whose cold-blooded report almost outdid Sinclair's novel. It related how piles of poisoned rats, rope ends, splinters, and other debris were scooped up and canned as potted ham. A cynical jingle of the time ran, "Mary had a little lamb, and when she saw it sicken, She shipped it off to Packingtown, and now it's labeled chicken. Backed by a nauseated public, Roosevelt induced Congress to pass the Meat Inspection Act of 1906. It decreed that the preparation of meat shipped over state lines would be subject to federal inspection from corral to can. Although the largest packers resisted certain features of the act, they accepted it as an opportunity to drive their smaller, fly-by-night competitors out of business. At the same time, they could receive the government seal of approval on their exports. As a companion to the Meat Inspection Act, the Pure Food and Drug Act of 1906 was designed to prevent the adulteration and mislabeling of foods and pharmaceuticals. Wasteful Americans, assuming that their natural resources were inexhaustible, had looted and polluted their incomparable domain with unparalleled speed and greed. Western ranchers and timbermen were especially eager to accelerate the destructive process, for they panted to build up the country, and the environmental consequences be hanged. But even before the end of the 19th century, far vision leaders saw that such a squandering of the nation's birthright would have to be halted, or America would sink from resource richness to despoiled dearth. The first feeble step toward conservation had been taken with the Desert Land Act of 1877, under which the federal government sold arid land cheaply on the condition that the purchaser irrigate the thirsty soil within 3 years. More successful was the Forest Reserve Act of 1891, authorizing the president to set aside public forests as national parks and other reserves. Under this statute, some 46 million acres of magnificent trees were rescued from the lumberman's saw in the 1890s and preserved for posterity. The Carey Act of 1894 distributed federal land to the states on the condition that it be irrigated and settled. A new day in the history of conservation dawned with Roosevelt Huntsman, naturalist, rancher, lover of the great outdoors. He was appalled by the pillaging of timber and mineral resources. Other dedicated conservationists, notably Gifford Pinkett, head of the Federal Division of Forestry, had broken important ground before him. But Roosevelt seized the banner of leadership and charged into the fray with all the weight of his prestige, his energy, his first-hand knowledge, and his slashing invective. The thirst of the desert still unslaked, Congress responded to the whip of the Rough Rider by passing the landmark Newlands Act of 1902. Washington was authorized to collect money from the sale of public lands in the sun-baked western states and then use these funds for the development of irrigation projects. Settlers repaid the cost of reclamation from their now productive soil, and the money was put into a revolving fund to finance more such enterprises. The giant Roosevelt Dam, constructed on Arizona's Salt River, was appropriately dedicated by Roosevelt in 1911. Thanks to this epical legislation, dozens of dams were thrown across virtually every major western river in the ensuing decades. Roosevelt pined to preserve the nation's shrinking forests. By 1900, only about a quarter of the once vast virgin timberlands remained standing. Lumbermen had already logged off most of the first growth timber from Maine to Michigan, and the sharp thud of their axes was beginning to split the silence in the great fir forests of the Pacific slope. Roosevelt proceeded to set aside in federal reserves some 125 million acres, or almost three times the acreage thus saved from the saw by his three predecessors. He similarly earmarked millions of acres of coal deposits, as well as water resources useful for irrigation and power. To set a shining example, in 1902 he banned Christmas trees from the White House. Conservation, including reclamation, may have been Roosevelt's most enduring tangible achievement. He was buoyed in this effort by an upwelling national mood of concern about the disappearance of the frontier believed to be the source of such national characteristics as individualism and democracy. An increasingly citified people worried that too much civilization might not be good for the national soul. City dwellers snapped up Jack London's Call of the Wild and other books about nature, and urban youngsters made the outdoor-oriented Boy Scouts of America the country's largest youth organization. The Sierra Club, founded in 1892, dedicated itself to preserving the wildness of the western landscape. The preservationists lost a major battle in 1913 when the federal government allowed the city of San Francisco to build a decameter for its municipal water supply in the spectacular, high-walled Hetch Hetchy Valley in Yosemite National Park. The Hetch Hetchy controversy laid bare a deep division among conservationists that persists to the present day. To the preservationists of the Sierra Club, including famed naturalist John Muir, Hetch Hetchy was a temple of nature that should be held inviolable by the civilizing hand of humanity. But other conservationists, among them President Roosevelt's chief forester, Gifford Pinkett, believed that wilderness was waste. Pinkett and Roosevelt wanted to use the nation's natural endowment intelligently. In their eyes, they had to battle on two fronts, against greedy commercial interests that abuse nature, as well as against romantic preservationists in thrall to simple woodman spare that tree sentimentality. Under Roosevelt, professional foresters and engineers developed a policy of multiple-use resource management. They sought to combine recreation, sustained yield logging, watershed protection, and summer stock grazing on the same expanse of federal land. At first, many Westerners resisted the federal management of natural resources, but they soon learned how to take advantage of new agencies like the Forest Service and especially the Bureau of Reclamation. The largest ranches and timber companies in particular figured out how to work hand in glove with federal conservation programs devoted to the rational, large-scale, and long-term use of natural resources. The one-man-and-a-mule logger or the one-man-and-a-dog sheep herder had little clout in the new resources bureaucracy. Single-person enterprises were shouldered aside, in the interest of efficiency, by the combined bulk of big business and big government. Roosevelt was handily elected president in his own right in 1904 and entered his new term buoyed by his enormous personal popularity. The cuddly teddy bear honored one of his bear hunting exploits when he saved the life of a cub, and children piped vigorously on whistles modeled on his famous teeth. Yet the conservative Republican bosses considered him as dangerous and unpredictable as a rattlesnake. They grew increasingly restive as Roosevelt in his second term called ever more loudly for regulating the corporations, taxing incomes, and protecting workers. Roosevelt, meanwhile, had partly befogged himself after his election in 1904 by announcing that under no circumstances would he be a candidate for a third term. This was a tactical blunder, for the power of the king wanes when the people know he will be dead in 4 years. Roosevelt suffered a sharp setback in 1907, when a short but punishing panic descended on Wall Street. The financial flurry featured frightened runs on banks, suicides, and criminal indictments against speculators. The financial world hastened to blame Roosevelt for the storm. It cried that this quack had unsettled industry with his boat-rocking tactics. Conservatives damned him as Theodore the Meddler and branded the horrendous stress the Roosevelt panic. The hot-tempered president angrily lashed back at his critics when he accused certain malefactors of great wealth of having deliberately engineered the monetary crisis to force the government to relax its assaults on trusts. Fortunately, the panic of 1907 paved the way for long-overdue fiscal reforms. Precipitating a currency shortage, the flurry laid bare the need for a more elastic medium of exchange. In a crisis of the sort, the hard-pressed banks were unable to increase the volume of money in circulation, and those with ample reserves were reluctant to lend to their less fortunate competitors. Congress in 1908 responded by passing the Aldrich-Vreeland Act, which authorized national banks to issue emergency currency backed by various kinds of collateral. The path was thus smoothed for the moment House Federal Reserve Act of 1913. Still warmly popular in 1908. Roosevelt could easily have won a second presidential nomination and almost certainly the election. But he felt bound by his impulsive post-election promise after his victory in 1904. The departing president thus naturally sought a successor who would carry out my policies. The man of his choice was amiable, ample-girthed, and huge-framed William Howard Taft, Secretary of War and a mild progressive. As an heir apparent, he had often been called upon in Roosevelt's absence to sit on the lid all 350 pounds of him. At the Republican Convention of 1908 in just Chicago, Roosevelt used his control of the party machinery, the steamroller, to push through Taft's nomination on the first ballot. 3 weeks later, in Mile High Denver, in the heart of Silver Country, the Democrats nominated twice-beaten William Jennings Bryan. The Doe campaign of 1908 featured the rotund Taft and the now balding boy orator both trying to don the progressive Roosevelt mantle. The solid Judge Taft read cut and dried speeches, while Bryan griped that Roosevelt had stolen his policies from the Bryanite camp. A majority of voters chose stability with Roosevelt endorsed Taft, who polled 321 electoral votes to 162 for Bryan. The victor's popular count was 7,675,320 to 6,412,294. The election's only surprise came from the Socialists, who amassed 420,793 votes for Eugene V. Debs, the hero of the Pullman strike of 1894. Roosevelt, ever in the limelight, left soon after the election for a lion hunt in Africa. His numerous enemies clinked glasses while toasting health to the lions, and a few irreverently prayed that some big cat would do its duty. But T.R. survived, still bursting with energy at the age of 51 in 1909. Roosevelt was branded by his adversaries as a wild-eyed radical, but his reputation as an eater of errant industrialists now seems inflated. He fought many a sham battle, and the number of laws he inspired was certainly not in proportion to the amount of noise he emitted. He was often under attack from the reigning business lords, but the more enlightened of them knew that they had a friend in the White House. Roosevelt should be remembered first and foremost as a cowboy who started to tame the bucking bronco of adolescent capitalism, thus ensuring it a long adult life. T.R.'s enthusiasm and perpetual youthfulness, like an overgrown Boy Scout's, appealed to the young of all ages. You must always remember, a British diplomat Couch and his colleagues, that the president is about six. He served as a political lightning rod to protect capitalists against popular indignation, and against socialism, which Roosevelt regarded as ominous. He strenuously sought the middle road between unbridled individualism and paternalistic collectivism. His conservation crusade, which tried to mediate between the romantic wilderness preservationists and the rapacious resource predators, was probably his most typical and his most lasting achievement. Several other contributions of Roosevelt lasted beyond his presidency. First, he greatly enlarged the power and prestige of the presidential office, and masterfully developed the technique of using the big stick of publicity as a political bludgeon. Second, he helped shape the progressive movement and beyond it the liberal reform campaigns later in the century. His Square Deal, in a sense, was the grandfather of the New Deal later launched by his fifth cousin, Franklin D. Roosevelt. Finally, to a greater degree than any of his predecessors, T.R. opened the eyes of Americans to the fact that they shared the world with other nations. As a great power, they had fallen heir to responsibilities, and had been seized by ambitions, from which there was no escaping. William Howard Taft, with his ruddy complexion and upturned mustache, at first inspired widespread confidence. Everybody loves a fat man, the saying goes, and the jovial Taft, with mirthquakes of laughter bubbling up from his abundant abdomen, was personally popular. He had graduated second in his class at Yale and had established an enviable reputation as a lawyer and judge, though he was widely regarded as hostile to labor unions. He had been a trusted administrator under Roosevelt, in the Philippines, at home, and in Cuba, where he had served capably as a troubleshooter. But good old Will suffered from lethal political handicaps. Roosevelt had led the conflicting elements of the Republican Party by the sheer force of his personality. Taft, in contrast, had none of the arts of a dashing political leader and none of Roosevelt's zest for the fray. Recoiling from the clamor of controversy, he generally adopted an attitude of passivity toward Congress. He was a poor judge of public opinion, and his candor made him a chronic victim of foot-and-mouth disease. Peaceful Bill was no doubt a mild progressive, but at heart he was more wedded to the status quo than to change. Significantly, his cabinet did not contain a single representative of the party's insurgent wing, which was on fire for reform of current abuses, especially the tariff. Though ordinarily lethargic, Taft bestirred himself to use the lever of American investments to boost American political interests abroad, an approach to foreign policy that his critics denounced as dollar diplomacy. Washington warmly encouraged Wall Street bankers to sluice their surplus dollars into foreign areas of strategic concern to the United States, especially in the Far East and in the regions critical to the security of the Panama Canal. By preempting investors from rival powers, such as Germany, New York bankers would thus strengthen American defenses and foreign policies, while bringing further prosperity to their homeland, and to themselves. The almighty dollar thereby supplanted the big stick. China's Manchuria was the object of Taft's most spectacular effort to inject the reluctant dollar into the Far Eastern theater. Duly ambitious Japan and imperialistic Russia, recent foes, controlled the railroads of the strategic province. President Taft saw in the Manchurian railway monopoly a possible strangulation of Chinese economic interests and a consequent slamming of the open door in the faces of U.S. merchants. In 1909, Secretary of State Flander C. Knox blunderingly proposed that a group of American and foreign bankers buy the Manchurian railroads and then turn them over to China under a self-liquidating arrangement. Both Japan and Russia, unwilling to be jockeyed out of their dominant position, bluntly rejected Knox's overture as Taft was showered with ridicule. Another dangerous new trouble spot was the revolution-riddled Caribbean, now virtually a Yankee lake. Hoping to head off trouble, Washington urged Wall Street bankers to pump dollars into the financial vacuums in Honduras and Haiti to keep out foreign funds. The United States, under the Monroe Doctrine, would not permit foreign nations to intervene, and consequently felt obligated to put its money where its mouth was to prevent economic and political instability. Again, necessity was the mother of armed Caribbean intervention. Sporadic disorders in palm-fronded Cuba, Honduras, and the Dominican Republic brought American forces to these countries to restore order and protect American investment. A revolutionary upheaval in Nicaragua, partly fomented by American interests, resulted in the landing of 2,500 Marines in 1912. The Marines remained in Nicaragua for 13 years. Taft managed to gain some fame as a smasher of monopolies. The ironic truth is that the colorless Taft brought 90 suits against the trusts during his 4 years in office, as compared with some 44 for Roosevelt in 7 years. By fateful happenstance, the most sensational judicial actions during the Taft regime came in 1911. In that year, the Supreme Court ordered the dissolution of the mighty Standard Oil Company, which was judged to be a combination in restraint of trade in violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890. At the same time, the court handed down its famous rule of reason. This doctrine held that only those combinations that unreasonably restrained trade were illegal. This fine print proviso ripped a huge hole in the government's antitrust net. Even more explosively, in 1911 Taft decided to press an antitrust suit against the U.S. Steel Corporation. This initiative infuriated Roosevelt, who had personally been involved in one of the mergers that prompted the suit. Once Roosevelt's protege, President Taft was increasingly taking on the role of his antagonist. The stage was being set for a bruising confrontation. Lowering the barriers of the formidable protective tariff, the mother of trusts, was high on the agenda of the progressive members of the Republican Party, and they at first thought they had a friend and ally in Taft. True to his campaign promises to reduce tariffs, Taft called Congress into special session in March 1909. The House proceeded to pass a moderately reductive bill, but senatorial reactionaries, led by Senator Nelson W. Aldrich of Rhode Island, tacked on hundreds of upward tariff revisions. Only items such as hides, sea moss, and canary seed were left on the duty-free list. After much hand-wringing, Taft signed the Payne-Aldrich bill, thus betraying his campaign promises and outraging the progressive wing of his party, heavily drawn from the Midwest. Taft rubbed salt in the wound by proclaiming it the best bill that the Republican Party ever passed. Taft revealed a further knack for shooting himself in the foot in his handling of conservation. The portly president was a dedicated conservationist, and his contributions actually equaled or surpassed those of Roosevelt. He established the Bureau of Mines to control mineral resources, rescued millions of acres of western coal lands from exploitation, and protected water power sites from private development. But those praiseworthy accomplishments were largely erased in the public mind by the noisy Bollinger-Pinkett quarrel that erupted in 1910. When Secretary of the Interior Richard Bollinger opened public lands in Wyoming, Montana, and Alaska to corporate development, he was sharply criticized by Gifford Pinkett, chief of the Agriculture Department's Division of Forestry, and a stalwart Rusev Olchin. When Taft dismissed Pinkett on the narrow grounds of insubordination, a storm of protest arose from conservationists and from Roosevelt's friends, who were legion. The whole unsavory episode further widened the growing rift between the president and the former president, one-time bosom political partners. The reformist wing of the Republican Party was now up in arms, while Taft was being pushed increasingly into the embrace of the stand-pat old guard. By the spring of 1910, The grand old party was split wide open, owing largely to the clumsiness of Taft. A suspicious Roosevelt returned triumphantly to New York in June 1910 and shortly thereafter stirred up a tempest. Unable to keep silent, he took to the stump at Osawatomie, Kansas, and shocked the old guard with a flaming speech. The doctrine that he proclaimed, popularly known as the New Nationalism, urged the national government to increase its power to remedy economic and social abuses. Weakened by these internal divisions, the Republicans lost badly in the congressional elections of 1910. In a victory of landslide proportions, the Democrats emerged with 228 seats, leaving the once dominant Republicans with only 161. In a further symptom of the reforming temper of the times, a socialist representative, Austrian-born Victor L. Berger, was elected from Milwaukee. The Republicans, by virtue of holdovers, retained the Senate, 51-41, but the insurgents in their midst were numerous enough to make that hold precarious. The sputtering uprising in Republican ranks had now blossomed into a full-fledged revolt. Early in 1911, the National Progressive Republican League was formed, with the fiery, white Maine Senator Lou Follette of Wisconsin its leading candidate for the Republican presidential nomination. The assumption was that Roosevelt, an anti-third-termer, would not permit himself to be drafted. But the restless Rough Rider began to change his views about third terms as he saw Taft, hand in glove with the hated old guard, discard my policies. In February 1912, Roosevelt formally wrote to seven state governors that he was willing to accept the Republican nomination. His reasoning was that the third-term tradition applied to three consecutive elective terms. Exuberantly he cried, "My hat is in the ring. And the fight is on, and I am stripped to the buff." Roosevelt forthwith seized the progressive banner, while La Follette, who had served as a convenient path-breaker, was protestingly elbowed aside. Girded for battle, the Rough Rider came clattering into the presidential primaries then being held in many states. He shouted through half-clenched teeth that the president had fallen under the thumb of the reactionary bosses and that, although Taft means well, he means well feebly. The once genial Taft, now in a fighting mood, retorted by branding Roosevelt supporters emotionalists and neurotics. A Taft-Roosevelt explosion was near in June 1912, when the Republican convention met in Chicago. The Rooseveltites, who were about 100 delegates short of winning the nomination, challenged the right of some 250 Taft delegates to be seated. Most of these contests were arbitrarily settled in favor of Taft, whose supporters held the throttle of the convention steamroller. The Roosevelt adherents, crying fraud and naked theft, in the end refused to vote, and Taft triumphed. Roosevelt, the supposedly good sportsman, refused to quit the game. Having tasted for the first time the bitter cup of defeat, he was now on fire to lead a third-party crusade. Examining the evidence. Buller v. Oregon, 1908. Court records provide terribly fruitful sources for historians. They not only tell zero-ften colorful stories about the lives of ordinary men and women caught up in the legal system. They also by their very nature testify to the norms and values that lawyers employ to make their cases and that judges invoke to explain their decisions. The case of Mueller v. Oregon is especially instructive on both counts. The official Supreme Court records tell how on September 4, 1905, Joe Hasselbach, a supervisor in Kurt Mueller's Grand Laundry in Portland, Oregon, asked an employee, Mrs. E. Gotcher, to remain after hours to do an extra load of laundry. That request violated Oregon's law prohibiting women from working more than 10 hours per day. Mrs. Gotcher later complained to the authorities, and Mueller was fined $10. Mueller refused to pay and took his case all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. In its landmark decision, the court upheld the constitutionality of the Oregon statute, and Mueller at last had to cough up his fine. On what grounds did the court justify its ruling? What does Justice David J. Brewer's argument on behalf of the court's decision suggest about the cultural identity and social role of women in early 20th century American society? The environmentalists. Humans have long been awed by nature, but they have also yearned to be its masters. Native American peoples did what they could to shape the natural environment to serve their purposes, burning forests and grasslands, for example, to improve hunting habitats, but they lacked the tools to make Mother Earth bow deeply to their will. The earliest European colonists saw North America as a howling wilderness and toiled mightily with axe and plow to tame it. By the mid-19th century, Americans commanded powerful new technologies like the railroad and steam-powered drills and dredges, which promised unbridled dominion over the natural world. Only then did voices begin to be heard in defense of the wounded earth, the faint first stirrings of what would come to be called environmentalism. In a pattern that would often be repeated, nature's earliest defenders tended to be well-off townsfolk and city dwellers, like Henry David Thoreau and Ralph Waldo Emerson. The Americans most likely to appreciate the value of the pristine wilderness, it seemed, were those who had ceased to struggle against it. Cities, not log cabins, produce Sierra Clubbers, one historian noted. For the loggers, miners, and farmers who continue to sweat their living out of nature's grudging embrace, concern for environmental niceties often seemed like the sanctimonious piety of a privileged elite. By the dawn of the 20th century, many genteel, urban Americans had come to romanticize their pioneer forebears. They reinvented hunting and fishing as sports for the well-to-do, not simply as ways to put food on the table. Preservationists like John Muir waxed lyrical about the mystic allure of unspoiled nature. Seizing the popular mood, Theodore Roosevelt deliberately constructed a public image of himself as a manly outdoorsman, raying cattle in the Dakotas, shooting lions in Africa, rafting down wild rivers in the Amazon basin, and as president he greatly expanded the system of national forests. But Roosevelt was also a pioneer of another sort, as a prominent promoter of the Progressive Area Conservation Movement, composed of a loose coalition of scientists, bureaucrats, and business people dependent on America's endowment of natural resources. Progressive conservationists believed that nature must be neither uncritically reverenced nor wastefully exploited, but must instead be efficiently utilized. Thus the same T.R. who admired the wonders of Yosemite Valley in the company of John Muir also supported the professional forester Gifford Pinkett, who declared that the object of our forest policy is not to preserve the forests because they are refuges for the wild creatures of the wilderness, but the making of prosperous homes use must be the test by which the forester tries himself. Pinkett's rational use philosophy guided America's natural resource policy until the mid-20th century. It justified the systematic harvesting of millions of trees in the sprawling national forest whose boundaries Roosevelt had expanded, and the drowning of vast river valleys behind massive dams that Roosevelt's Reclamation Service helped to build. This attitude toward nature triumphed in the New Deal era of the 1930s, when the federal government initiated colossal projects that undertook nothing less than re-engineering the face of the continent, including the Tennessee Valley Authority, the Soil Conservation Service, and the Shelter Belt Tree Planting Project on the Great Plains. The huge reach of these New Deal projects also introduced millions of Americans to the concept that nature had to be treated with respect, helping to stimulate the post-World War II grassroots environmental movement. The rise of ecological science in the post-World War II era fundamentally changed the debate about the relation of nature to civilization. Ecologists charged that the apparent rationality of the earlier conservationists dangerously neglected the fateful intricacies of biological systems. They called attention to the stunningly complex webs of interrelationships that link together seemingly unrelated organisms, and to the perils of tampering even slightly with the delicate biological fabrics that nature had taken millennia to weave. Rachel Carson helped to popularize the new outlook in her sensational 1962 exposé, Silent Spring, about the far-reaching effects of pesticides on birds, plants, and animals, including humans. The advent of ecological studies coincided with a revival of preservationist sentiment, especially in the suburbs, where Americans increasingly dwelled. Hordes of affluent baby boomers took to America's trails, slopes, and waterways to hike, bike, ski, fish, boat, and otherwise recreate, often on public lands like Arizona's wondrous Grand Canyon National Park, or public waters like Utah's shimmering and man-made Lake Powell. Membership in environmental organizations such as the Sierra Club and the Audubon Society soared, as a generation infatuated with nature demanded a clean and green world. The first celebration of Earth Day, on April 22, 1970, marked the political maturation of modern-day environmentalism, which wedded scientific analysis with respect for nature's majesty. that same year saw the creation of the Federal Environmental Protection Agency EPA, soon followed by the Endangered Species Act and other legislation designed to regulate the relationship between humans and nature. At the outset of the 21st century, developments like global warming served dramatic notice that planet Earth was the biggest ecological system of them all, one that did not recognize national boundaries. Yet while Americans took pride in the efforts they had made to clean up their own turf, who were they, having long since consumed much of their own timberlands, to tell the Brazilians that they should not cut down the Amazon rainforest? Who were they, having tamed virtually all their own free-flowing waters, to tell the Chinese not to dam their rivers? For the peoples of the developing world, struggling to match America's standard of living, environmentalists often seemed like spoiled spoilers, preaching the same privileged pieties that had infuriated generations of working Americans.